Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain at the hidden world of monetary control, control that determines global economic winners and losers and who benefits. Ellen Brown is a lawyer, scholar, and best-selling author of Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution. She's the founder of the Public Banking Institute and a prolific contributor to the growing discussion about the evolving world of economic theory. Later in the program, we'll take a look at new developments within the public banking movement. But now, here's Ellen. Money, get away.
Thanks, Walt. Today we're going to focus on the ongoing battle against MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems. We've talked about it before, and I've written quite a bit on it. It's an electronic database that holds 70% of U.S. mortgages. Today, only 29% of homes are owned free and clear, a record low. So that means that MERS holds 70% of 70%, or about half of all the homes in the country. At least they're recorded in the name of MERS. So there's been a lot of litigation about this, and in the earlier cases, the homeowners were making some progress in establishing that MERS broke the chain of title to these properties because MERS wasn't the real owner. The real owner is the party putting up the money, usually the investors, because these properties are virtually all securitized. And you can't tell from the records at the county recording office who the real owner is. So that's can be a real problem for the borrower, and many issues have come up over this, and so there have been a lot of lawsuits about it. But lately, the cases have gone against the homeowners and in favor of MERS. There was a really good article a year ago in the legal journal, The California Lawyer, by Thomas Brom. It was called In MERS We Trust. He was cataloging the state of the law at that time, and he started out, "When you get your pocket picked by a real pro, sometimes all you can do is appreciate the artistry. Such, apparently, is the case with MERS, a national electronic database of home mortgages that effectively swiped millions of dollars from local governments just when they could have used the revenue most." So then he reviews all the cases, and he concludes, "You have to at least admire the audacity of this scheme. Under our very noses, the banking industry created a private registry of mortgages that offers homeowners little accountability, slashes millions of dollars from county revenue, and skates over hundreds of years of state property laws." So that was how things were going a year ago. But last month, a county recorder in Pennsylvania had a stunning victory against MERS. Her name is Nancy Becker, and I'll be talking to her today, along with her two brilliant attorneys. First, though, I just want to mention another lawsuit, which is the subject of my latest article. Homeowners have routinely lost their suits against the big mortgage banks because they just don't have the money to stand up to them. But the tables may be turning. Last month, some of the world's largest banks got sued by some of the world's largest investor groups, led by BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, and PIMCO, the world's largest bond fund manager. The banks they are suing were trustees for the Investors Mortgage Investment Trust. They are charged with breaching their fiduciary duty to sue the lenders to buy back defective loans. And we know now, of course, that there were a lot of defective loans. What is particularly stunning about this case is the size of the damage claim, $250 billion. The London whale fiasco that shook J.P. Morgan was only $6 billion, so $250 billion is 40 times the London whale. It's the equivalent of if you had a million homeowners and they each claimed $250,000 in damages and they all sued at once. So that's some significant firepower. The question is, can the banks withstand that sort of damage? And what if they don't? The Dodd-Frank Act says there would be no more taxpayer bailouts. So if one of the big banks goes bankrupt, who will pick up the tab? We've been waiting for the first U.S. bail-in, and this could be it. In a bail-in, the banks are instructed to and have set out plans for recapitalizing themselves with the money of their creditors, and that includes their shareholders, their bondholders, and the largest class of creditor of any bank, their depositors. So we could be facing a Cyprus situation right here in the U.S. where you go to your online account and open it up and there's nothing in it, or it's substantially written down, or it's frozen and you can't get in it. So then what would happen? Would there be a run on the banks? Probably. Would the whole system come crashing down, as some pundits are suggesting? Or would the government do what Franklin Roosevelt did in 1933 in those circumstances, declare a bank holiday and rush through some emergency measures? In fact, this could be our opportunity for a major overhaul to a system that is clearly corrupt and unsustainable. Congress might even go so far as to reclaim the power to create money, which it's had all along in the Constitution. If we had some government-issued money, we could go a long way toward solving our financial problems. At the state level, states might consider setting up their own banks along the lines of the Bank of North Dakota. In fact, they need to do this not just to protect their own revenues, but because it can be a huge moneymaker for the state. That's money that right now we're just giving away to Wall Street. So those are my thoughts. You can read more on my blog at ellenbrown.com. And now it's time to hear from our guests. Today I had the pleasure of talking with Nancy Becker, Joseph Cohn, and Craig Helwig, who recently scored a landmark victory, or at least a partial victory, against MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, an electronic database that manages about 70% of the nation's mortgages. Nancy is the recorder of deeds for Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, outside Philadelphia. Her victorious challenge to MERS has been called the David and Goliath tale. She gives the credit to her brilliant attorneys, Joe and Craig, who are class action, consumer protection, and antitrust lawyers from Cohn, Swift, and Graff in Philadelphia. Greetings, Nancy, Joe, and Craig.
Hello.
Nancy, perhaps you could start by telling us what MERS is and why you decided to take them to court.
MERS is the Mortgage Electronic Registry System that was implemented in the late 90s. And I think when I first became the recorder in 2004, I was aware of MERS but never really understood some of the effects it was having on the residents here in Montgomery County. In 2006, it really became evident of what was happening. I had contacted the Attorney General thinking that this was something that the state should really look into, but didn't really get a response. And so in 2011, talked to my solicitor, and he suggested I contact Joe Cohn about filing a suit. I was aware of the problem prior to filing the suit, especially when residents came into the office facing foreclosures at what appeared to be a break in the chain of title, rather than their ability or inability to pay their mortgages. And so I really was looking to do this to protect our residents.
Could you explain that further? How were they being injured that was not their fault?
Well, in some instances, the mortgage was sold multiple times, and they may have been paying their mortgage and it was going to a lockbox. But because there was no true chain of where it should go, the entity that currently owned that mortgage was not getting paid. So the people were getting foreclosure notices.
Wow.
Another thing that I found out actually just yesterday was with insurance companies. When a huge insurance claim is filed because of damages to someone's home, the insurance company usually makes the check payable for the repairs to the homeowner and the mortgage company. Well, they're making those checks payable to the mortgage company as of record that they see on the county recorder's office, and that is not correct. So some of these people are unable to cash the checks so that they can pay for the damages to their homes.
And the other thing
is that I feel very clearly, and Joe will talk about it more because he's the attorney, that Pennsylvania law states that the mortgages shall be recorded in the county offices, and they're not. So therefore, the counties are losing revenue for the recording fees.
Mm-hmm. It's my understanding that it's not necessary for mortgages to be recorded everywhere. Is that true? Is Pennsylvania sort of unique in that way? I mean, you do have to record it if you want to prove title as against some challenger. But let's say my mother wanted to convey a part of her home to me. She could do that privately without recording it here in California, I think. Is that correct?
Well, if she's conveying part of the ownership to you, that's the deed. The mortgage is basically held by the financial institution that's lending the money so that you can purchase the home.
Oh, so any more, is that, so that, so what's true in Pennsylvania would also be true in other states, or are some of them different?
Ellen, this is Joe Cohn, and thanks for talking with us today. These are state-by-state recording laws. They have similarities, and some states can be grouped together. But the Pennsylvania law is a particularly strongly worded law in terms of the mandatory requirement to record any conveyance of land, any encumbrance, and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has previously determined that a mortgage assignment is a conveyance. So some of those links are not present in other states. We are not bringing actions in other states. We're focused on Pennsylvania law, but we're familiar with some decisions from some other courts, and MERS has tried to rely on some of these decisions from other states. And the court in Pennsylvania, it's a federal court sitting in Philadelphia, has determined that those cases do not apply because the Pennsylvania law stands on its own and has stronger and more mandatory language than other states do.
Yeah, that's
so it is somewhat of a state-by-state analysis.
I understood it was sort of a competition between UCC law and state land rights or whatever, state law. But in Pennsylvania, at least, the state laws would apply. Is that correct?
Right. So and we think that they're complementary with the UCC laws and consistent that these are, in fact, conveyances.
You want to go into more detail in what the actual judgment was and what that means and what that means in Pennsylvania and what it might mean for other states? I know that the court said that MERS had to come up with the assignments past, present, and future, which seems to me probably impossible. Is that correct? And if they don't do it, what happens? Have they lost title? Is there a clear break in the chain of title in those properties? And do they then revert to the state, escheat to the state, or what happens to those properties?
I think that what the court has determined at this stage is the trial court decision, which is subject to a right to appeal at some point, is that the procedure in Pennsylvania, which goes back to colonial days, that the chain of title with respect to real estate and land is a matter of public record and is required by state laws to be filed in the county recorder of deeds office so that anyone in the public, any potential creditor, any potential purchaser, any relative of the owner can go to the public documents and see what the truth is about the property. MERS was created for the purpose of saying, oh, no, we have a better idea, the banking industry. Let's create our own private secret system. It can only be accessed by financial institutions that want to buy and sell these mortgages for their own profit reasons. And let's skip the public recording. We won't have to pay the fees. We will save, this is in the words of the MERS founders, billions of dollars for the banking industry as we buy and sell and trade mortgages and mortgage loans around the country, and which is fine, except that there's a law in Pennsylvania that says these instruments and these writings must be recorded in the public domain, and that's really the nuts and bolts of what the court has determined, that after briefing from both sides and reviewing the evidence, that the Pennsylvania law does require that recording in Pennsylvania.
Will they be able to comply, though? Will they be able to come up with all those assignments?
Well, MERS, in years past, would file foreclosure actions in the name of the, or on behalf of, the entity that purported to have the right to do that. It would file it in the name of MERS. Now, MERS represented to the courts and to the homeowner that they were foreclosing on that they knew who had the mortgage, that who had that right to collect the revenue, and who had the right to foreclose. MERS has represented to its membership, the banking industry, that this is a system that will stand in lieu of the public recording system. So we believe they can. Will they be 100% accurate? Perhaps not. But whatever it is they have, whatever it is that their records and their system, which they created, we didn't create it, they did, should be now placed onto the public record.
Well, my understanding, too, is that typically the mortgages were not assigned to the trust within the closing period as required under the pooling and servicing agreements. They didn't bother to assign them until they went into foreclosure, and that was why they had to do all that robo-signing to fake these assignments as if they had been timely assigned back. And the reason was that they're using these mortgage-backed securities as pawns in the repo market in the meantime. I mean, they want them signed in blank so that they can be like negotiable instruments that can serve as collateral. So they're like two markets going at once. Well, I don't know if you saw this recent, there was a $250 billion lawsuit filed by PIMCO and BlackRock against, I think it was U.S. Bank and Wells Fargo and Deutsche Bank, among others. I mean, that is a huge, huge size lawsuit. Will they be able to withstand that? But they're suing because they didn't comply with their duties as trustees for the investors. But apparently the reason they didn't do it was that they were simultaneously dealing in this other system, and they, you know, if they did one, then they would be risking getting sued from the other. It's a bit complicated. I'm not really sure of all the details
of
it.
Well, I think it's another symptom of the same problem. They certainly represent to the investing public that these securities were backed by the mortgage. That's why they call them mortgage-backed securities. And these financial institutions, which were putting out billions of dollars, we believe, thought that they had those rights. They created this system. It's their responsibility to unravel it. And our case is one small piece of that. Pennsylvania is the keystone state, so maybe it'll be an important piece of it. But
yeah.
They should unravel to the best of their records. Let's see what they look like.
And I guess your lawsuit is paid for by the county. Is that correct? I mean, that's one big advantage to a public lawsuit over when homeowners try to bring these suits. They're so easily crushed because they're up against
these big fence. We have brought this action as a class action and on behalf of all Pennsylvania counties. And the court has also certified the class as a class action. And we here, it's no secret, have brought it as a contingency fee case, and any recovery that is ultimately obtained from MERS or the MERS members will have to be approved by the court, and any award to the lawyers for their work and time and expenses will also have to be approved by the judge after a notice to the class, just as you would in any kind of a class action in the securities world or in the consumer protection world.
Are the recording fees, and we cannot share them with the attorneys. So if Judge Joyner says that, you know, they have to pay and record all these assignments, that all those monies for recording fees goes to the counties. The judge hopefully will also look at damages and award a fee to the attorneys for their trouble and their due diligence to bring this to correct the chain of title for all of these mortgages. So it's not costing the county or tax dollars any money.
Wow, that's great. And yet you still have the strength of the counties behind it.
I was just going to say, I think it does send a message to MERS that a public official in a major county in a major state is willing to stand up to this and has the support of the other officials in the county, the county commission, and others to pursue this.
Well, it does seem to me that if they have to make all their records public, I'm guessing that there are flaws in all those chains of title that they don't really want known, partly because they didn't convey those properties back to the trusts in time. It seems to me that there might arguably be defects in title to 50% of the real estate in the country, because only 29% are held free and clear now, I read. Yeah. And 70% of the rest are held in the name of MERS, and they might all be flawed. Mm-hmm. But no, how does your suit relate, say, to California? I live in California.
Well, it does only to the extent that a law in California may be comparable or the same as the requirements in Pennsylvania. And, you know, just off the top of my head, I don't know what the California recording statutes mm-hmm. provide. Although, as you point out, it's like you have a loose thread on a suit jacket, and you start to pull it, and sometimes, you unravel more than is there. And if they have to disclose their data in Pennsylvania or try to clean up their records in Pennsylvania, it may be some indication of the issues that may arise.
What the records
in other
look
places.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Technology is amazing today, Ellen. We can actually go into our system and search through thousands and thousands of mortgages and determine which of those mortgages were MERS related. Probably 20 years ago, before technology was what it is, it would be a huge task to identify them. But now, pretty much with a click of a button, we can get a report and find out exactly which mortgages were attached to MERS.
And I suppose they only have to record the trust itself. So you don't have to record every time some investor buys into some tranche of some trust, correct? I mean, there are still
correct,
only a few recordings in the chain that are required. So, like, typically, how many assignments would be in a mortgage before it went to foreclosure?
Mr. O'Brien, who's the recorder in Massachusetts, actually had a forensic expert come in, and he guesstimated that the mortgages were assigned as many as 12 times.
Wow. So that, and how much is the recording fee per assignment?
In Pennsylvania, the recording fee for an assignment is $64.
So it's how many mortgages are there in the country?
Did some rough estimating, and also have gotten some responses from MERS, but if you took a number of, let's say, around 150,000 mortgages in Montgomery County that appear to be MERS related, and use those kinds of numbers, you get into multi-millions of dollars for that one county pretty quickly. Even
wow.
if you took a conservative estimate, let's say instead of 12 assignments, let's just say 5.
Yeah, I think,
large.
Joe, when we did our preliminary research, it was just on assigning it twice, which came up with the $15 million for that
right.
time frame. So,
and who would pay this judgment? I mean, I thought MERS was sort of an empty shell. Is there?
Well, that's one of the things we're going to find out, as back to my analogy of unraveling the threads on the suit, and we'll see what's mm-hmm. behind there. MERS is created by and backed by has indemnification agreements with its members, which is the entire U.S. banking industry. And $15 million to them is, what's in their piggy bank.
Yeah, when I first became aware of this, we were banking with Wells Fargo here as the county, and I, in conscience, could no longer have them as our bank. So I went to a community bank and changed all of our deposits to a community bank that was not MERS affiliated, because I felt I couldn't do business with a bank that I might be suing in the future.
Right. Well, that's what my particular thing is, state-owned banks. I think every state should have its own bank on the model of the Bank of North Dakota, the only state that does have its own bank at the moment.
Sure.
But for that same reason, the only banks that the state can bank with, or any city or any large public entity, are the Wall Street banks, because they're the only ones that are big enough that can handle all their deals and that are able to put up the collateral. They're supposed to back their public deposits 110% in collateral, and it doesn't help the little banks to do that, because then they can't use those deposits. But the big banks, apparently it does help them, because they're actually double dealing in the collateral. That's what I've it appears that, like, they'll say, oh, we've got all these federal securities as collateral, but they're using those federal securities at the same time as collateral in the repo market to make loans to themselves or to take out loans, which they then speculate with. So they're proven fraudsters in things like the LIBOR riggings. So here we are doing business with proven crooks, which they're actually laws against. Seems to me, if for no other reason, they should be set up their own large bank, put their own deposits in it, and back it with their own capital and direct it to their own interests. But also they can save 50% on the cost of public projects that way, because they can save the interest. I'd love to hear more on your insights on all this and how you got up the nerve to sue them. I mean, there have been other county recorder suits, but
there have been other county recorder suits. There have been attorney general suits from different states. I just felt that I was elected as the recorder of deeds, and it was my fiduciary responsibility to not only collect all the fees due the county, but to protect the land records and keep the chain of title for the residents of Montgomery County. And so I felt I had no other choice but to do something. I was very lucky that my solicitor, Jeff Schaefer, had suggested Joe Cohn for this lawsuit. It has been an amazing experience for me so far. And just knowing that it's bringing light to a real flaw in what's been happening throughout the country, and the chain of title being broken on millions of mortgages, and people are losing their homes or facing foreclosure, which has to be a horrendous experience for them. And it's not their fault. We had a young couple in the office a couple of months ago. She was like 9 months pregnant, and they had a letter saying that their house was going to be foreclosed on. And her husband had all of the canceled checks with him. And luckily, one of the attorneys that was filing some documents in the office, it had happened to him. And he said, what happens is you're sending the money into a lockbox. The lockbox went with all these assignments, and it's not being tracked correctly, doesn't know who to send the money to. So the person who actually now is due the money has not gotten the money and starts the foreclosure process. And for some people, especially this couple, they had gotten a letter before and ignored it, saying, well, you know, we're paying our mortgage. And then when they got the second letter, they came in and said, you know, what do we do? Luckily, mm-hmm. there are attorneys that work in the building where our recording office is, and someone was able to see them that same day, because they had 2 days with which to do something, or their house would have been thrown into foreclosure. So I just feel that I have the responsibility to do whatever I can to do what the residents of Montgomery County elected me to do.
And another problem with that is that I just interviewed Professor Robert Hockett, our last program, who has brought these eminent domain. His thing is that the counties or the cities should put these properties into eminent domain take them by eminent domain, which are heavily underwater, because even though it would be in everybody's best interest to work out to renegotiate the mortgages, they can't do it because of these poorly written pooling and servicing agreements that just don't allow renegotiation, and you can't even necessarily find all the investors. So it's necessary to have some central body, such as the county itself, to some neutral body to renegotiate the whole thing in a fair way.
The reason our country was founded was that so that people could own land. And way back then, those people that created our laws understood that it was very important to be able to track who owns the land. We also, in the recorder's office, record all the notary commissions. And I think the reason for that is as people were selling land throughout Pennsylvania, certainly, and throughout the nation, they had to have somebody there to acknowledge that the person who was, quote, selling the land was in truth a landowner and who they were selling it to. And so it started way back then when we became a nation, the importance of keeping a clear chain of title for these land records. And MERS mm-hmm. has broken that chain of title. And mm-hmm. somehow we have to fix it. And if somebody just sits back and does nothing, it continues. And, you know, I'm probably a little recorder from Montgomery County, but I feel if I would have sat back, I couldn't, you know, I would feel that I was not doing what I was elected to do.
Well, that's great. And it's so Pennsylvania, too, like you said. It's the home of the Constitution, and my relatives are from Pennsylvania.
So. Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, it was amazing how brilliant these people were. Also in the Recorder of Deeds office, we also record all the military discharges. And I think our forefathers understood that land records and military records really should be held in perpetuity. And at the time, the Recorder of Deeds office was the only one that was doing it, so now we continue to do it. But to understand how important it was, our records in Montgomery County go back to 1784. And we can look wow. up a deed from 1784 and find out who owned the property, who they sold it to, and what bank or financial institution financed it. And that was what the vision was of our forefathers, to protect land rights and to protect the people's ability to own land, and so we have to continue doing that. The other thing mm-hmm. is what most people don't realize, that most small businesses start with a loan on somebody's home. So the whole idea of capitalism and being able to, you know, start small businesses all starts from the land records. Most people don't even know that there is a recorder of deeds in their county. Or feel that it's a very important position, but I feel it's as important as any elected official in the entire Commonwealth.
No, I agree, and the reason that MERS has destroyed all that is this is what I write about all the time, is to keep a corrupt banking system going. It's a system where banks create money on their books, and I mean the Bank of England just admitted to that. Banks do not actually lend their depositors money. Every time they make a loan, they create the money on their books. They do it by double entry bookkeeping. But it goes all the way back to like the 19th century, the 18th century, when banks were dealing with gold and they were lending out many more paper notes than they had gold. And so there'd be periodic bank runs. So then we had the savings and loan crisis in the 80s because banks were lending long, like 30-year mortgages, and they were taking in short-term, or they had to pay on their short-term deposits, and then the interest rate went up to 20%, and they had these outstanding 5% loans, so they couldn't, you know, long-term loans. So in order to get around that whole borrowing short, lending long problem, they got into securitization, where they're selling off our real estate as pawns in this whole market of backing loans with bits of real estate that are fungible, that are traded between investors and can be traded on some sort of liquid market. So it's all to support a system in which banks create our money sort of fraudulently and pretend to have the money themselves. So it seems to me that the whole system needs to be rethought. I mean, today there's no gold backing money anywhere. It's all just credits and debits. And it could be set up in a way so that the whole system is public, all the profits go back to the public, and then it would be sustainable. So that's what I write about, and that's why I'm totally interested in the progress you're making and the things that your lawsuit has revealed, and I'll definitely be keeping an eye on it to see what more comes of it.
Yeah, I was very pleased. As I said, way back in the early 2000s, I did contact the Attorney General's office. We've had several Attorney Generals since I've been in office. I've been here for 10 years and never got a response. But most recently, the current Attorney General has written a favorable opinion of our lawsuit. So that strengthens us also, I think, here in the Commonwealth.
Well, and it seems like there's more and more disillusion with the big banks, and so people are ready to see these problems. I know one man told me, who is an expert in the field, he said, that may be the law, but there's just no way the courts are going to throw out the big banks, that, you know, just to, that it would cause their whole system to crumble. But I don't know. I think people are getting closer and closer, getting more and more fed up with the current system. And particularly if we had something good to replace it with, I think people might be ready to say, well, that's the law and we've got to proceed with it.
Websites, I think, or anything? This has been good. I really appreciate your interest, and I'm excited that we will be able to win and return the chain of title, which should have been there all along, mm-hmm. and secondary, get the counties the fees that they should have been getting all along, because every county, not only in the Commonwealth, I'm sure throughout the nation, they're all hurting, trying to balance budgets. And so this would be a wonderful infusion of cash into the Commonwealth, which I think would be good for all the residents. But the most important thing is really to keep that chain of title for all these land records.
That's great, and I totally applaud you for your work.
You know, it's something my husband laughs and says, you know, what can one person do? And maybe not a whole lot, but if you don't try, you don't do anything. Absolutely had to try. And
yeah.
Again, I was very lucky to be able to have Joe Cohn and his firm represent us. Because
if everyone had your attitude, the problem would be fixed.
Yes, yes. So we're hoping. And the one good thing that this has happened is that we are seeing more assignments being recorded, and maybe it's because they understand that it's going to be required. That's my perception. I could be totally wrong, but I'm hoping that they're understanding that it's important to record all these assignments of mortgage.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's great. Well, congratulations.
So it was a pleasure talking with you.
And you too, and congratulations on your success so far.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye. That was Nancy Becker, Recorder of Deeds for Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, and her attorneys, Joseph Cohen and Craig Helwig.
On the Public Banking Report this week, we'll be talking with Ira Dember, the co-founder of Bank Act, which is leading the charge to create postal banks around the United States as a way of expanding post office business, revenues, and most importantly, new banking services for the 25% of Americans who are unbanked, many of them in America's poorest cities. The effort recently got a major boost by adoption of a resolution by the U.S. Conference of Mayors calling for the post office to help implement the postal banks in their branches around the country. One of the advantages of using post offices as sources for simple banking functions and services is that they are in all the cities, and they are in locations where banks have long since abandoned because there's no profit in the poor neighborhoods. It's also reviving a practice of postal operations of providing savings bank services to Americans, which only ended in 1966, partially at the behest of congressional pressure. It's congressional pressure that the post office is up against now as it tries to diversify and improve services. In 2006, Congress created a major financial obstacle for post office success by mandating that it fund its pension fund for decades ahead of current needs. So with no further ado, let's talk to Ira Dember. Ira, welcome to the Public Banking Report, and tell us how you got involved in the postal banking effort.
I got inspired by the report issued by the Inspector General of the U.S. Postal Service, and it was staggering. I was just not aware of the scale of the problem created by payday lenders and other financial predators, the check cashers, the payment cards with excessive fees, things like that. According to the report, $89 billion a year, and this was 2012, was going out the door, mostly from the pockets of poor people, basically low-wage working families and retirees, people living on trying to get along on Social Security.
$89 billion?
That's right, billion would be.
Through what?
Interest rates and fees. I'll use payday lenders as the leading example, and there's also auto title lenders, which are set up similarly. They set you up to fail. People go to payday lenders, and they know that they're getting ripped off, but they're desperate. When you're living paycheck to paycheck, and there just is never enough to go around, and you're juggling between paying the rent and paying the utilities, always being a little bit behind, and then something happens, the car breaks down, your kid gets sick, stuff like that, and you desperately need more money, just a small amount, before your payday comes. So you go take out a payday loan, and you know it's a bad deal. But you feel like you have no choice because the alternative of not having it is catastrophic. You could get evicted. Your kid could die. In the meantime, you're getting ripped off. With the fees that they pile in there, it comes to an effective interest rate, on average, of 400% per annum.
Wow. How can they get away with that kind of usurious rate?
They have loopholes that are left in laws and regulations. A small handful of states have shut down those loopholes. 32 states, it's wide open. They can charge whatever they want. And you're right, it's usury.
Describe what a postal bank would look like.
The services that I've described are generally referred to as non-bank financial services. And that's what the Inspector General proposed that the Postal Service start offering.
Non-bank services would be specifically like...
Payment cards, reloadable payment cards. You load it up with cash, mm-hmm. or your employer puts the cash directly on the card, and you can mm-hmm. spend it. On a lot of those cards, you're paying money every time you want to take out your own money from that card, and it adds up. The people who take out payday loans, and there are millions of working families who do this every single year. How much do you think somebody pays for a $375 loan? $520, and that's just the interest and fees.
Are these payday loan people independent agencies, or are they bankrolled by larger firms?
There's actually a report out, a group called the California Reinvestment Coalition, that shows that traced the funding of the major payday lenders in this country. They go back to the big Wall Street banks, the same banks who committed mortgage fraud and brought the economy crashing down in 2008. Those same banks are the ones bankrolling the payday predators and the other predators, such as the check cashers and the rent-to-own people. Actually, Wells Fargo is the single biggest offender. They bankroll more payday lenders than anybody else. Bank of America is number two. Chase Bank, they're in there too.
Has there been any other legislative initiative against this?
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren's Consumer Protection Financial Bureau, right, thank you, CFPB. Yeah, they're looking at ways, to get it under control because it's such a major problem.
So people in low-income neighborhoods have no banks, but they do have post offices, right?
They need some way of getting these small loans. If they can't get enough money to help a family survive, where are they going to turn? The banks won't give it to them, right? The banks have abandoned these people. 60%, almost 60% of post offices in this country are located in zip codes that have no bank branches at all or just one.
Hasn't there been any legislation to try to alleviate this really criminal, abusive, predatory situation for neighborhoods?
A lot of legislators justify the criminality going on here by the true fact that if you shut down the payday lenders, then people who are getting screwed by employers with poverty wages will have nowhere to turn when they do face eviction, when the car does break down. How else are they going to get that bit of money?
So how would a local postal bank help people in that situation?
Well, I mentioned that $375 average loan with the average fees of $520. The Postal Service could offer that same loan for about the same amount of time, actually a little bit longer, for $48, a little less than one-tenth the price.
So Bank Act had a recent victory, a significant development, as the U.S. Conference of Mayors adopted a resolution asking the Inspector General, or agreeing with the Postal Inspector General's report, and standing with the idea of creating postal banks in communities around the country. You guys think that was a bit of a no-brainer for the mayors to stand with that. Why is that?
Because when that money goes back in people's pockets, instead of going to the creditors and to Wall Street, those people are going to spend money locally, right? They're going to pay the rent, and they're also going to buy taxable goods. So we estimate that about $3 billion a year will be gained in sales tax revenues by cities and towns across America if all this money went back to people and we put the payday lenders out of business. There is only one low-cost alternative that can be implemented nationwide, and that is the U.S. Postal Service. That money becomes an economic stimulus, so now you're talking more money going into Main Street businesses because there's more money there to spend. Again, we're talking over $80 billion a year. So all that money goes back as an economic stimulus into the local economy. And that's part of, again, what got the mayor's attention, because it means more jobs created in their cities, too. One of the things that the Inspector General proposed was something called postal savings, where people could open small savings accounts at the post office. This is not a new idea. This was actually done for over 50 years, from about 1911 to about 1966. And for a time, it was a huge success. About one family in 10 had a postal savings account. If your family goes back that far, your grandma may have done it in her day. It was a huge success. Mm-hmm. Congress eventually killed it by preventing the Postal Service from increasing its interest rates to be competitive. So eventually people lost interest in it. They could get better rates at the banks, and the Postal Service got out of that business. What we envision is that if that part of the Inspector General's proposal were implemented, then you'd have a lot of people opening small savings accounts at the post office. There'd be a lot of money there. Billions of dollars would suddenly be available in savings deposits. One of the ways that productive use could be made of those deposits would be to help fund a national infrastructure bank, which is something that many elected officials, including President Obama, have recommended, on both sides of the aisle, by the way, have recommended. An infrastructure bank would essentially let states and cities fund public projects, roads, bridges, schools, parks. Any capital projects like that could be funded at lower costs than Wall Street currently charges. Pool of money that could be lent out to cities, to cities, counties, states, to help fund their projects at lower costs. Much lower costs than the rates they can get from Wall Street. This means billions of dollars that are kept in public coffers to help fund other things, like fire, police. It would work for everybody except Wall Street.
So what do the political prospects look like for getting a postal bank movement underway in Congress?
I do know that in terms of getting postal banking implemented, it's an uphill battle. Because Wall Street certainly doesn't want the postal bank happening. The postal bank, because it would involve huge amounts of money, a small amount of profit for the post office, would help stabilize post office finances. As you may know, Congress has been systematically sabotaging the post office to try to put it on such unstable finances that it has to be privatized. No more regular mail delivery, costs go up, crap wages. That has to do with the Postmaster General of the U.S. Postal Service is one of the big, he doesn't say it outright, but he's one of the big cheerleaders for privatization. Mm-hmm. That's why in California now, they've already implemented postal services at some Staples stores, and why there is a boycott against Staples nationwide. Because people don't want this happening. The post office has been an independent entity for over 230 years. The post office actually predates the formation of the United States. And people want to keep it that way because the service is good, despite what you may sometimes think.
Yeah, it's actually quite remarkable, considering what they will do for 48 cents, in getting a letter from here to wherever in a couple of days. But many other remarkable services that are there. And, of course, the postal services around the world are quite vibrant, much more so than ours now. This is not the first time or the only place that this has been tried.
Postal banking is implemented in different countries in different ways, but over 1 billion people, 1 billion people, mostly in the developed world, can bank, do some kind of banking at their local post office. It's Americans. Talk about American exceptionalism. Yeah, we're exceptional, all right. We're one of the only developed countries where we're deprived of the privilege of going down to the neighborhood post office and doing some banking there.
You suggested that there's some pretty strong congressional opposition to helping the post office do a better job or make its way and be more vibrant in Congress. What else can you say about that?
Well, the primary, there are many conservative opponents who want to see the post office die. They want to see it privatized. They want to turn it over to private hands, private profit, instead of having it continue as a public service. The leading opponent in Congress is Darrell Issa, ISSA. Perhaps not coincidentally, he's also the richest man in Congress. He's worth $450 million.
Wow.
And by the way, the Postmaster General, who is in cahoots with Issa on this thing, and who is trying to kill the Postal Service, which he's responsible for, he's the second highest paid federal official. Through the money you pay for postage stamps and whatnot, we're supporting this guy to the tune of his salary is over $23,000 per month.
Per month.
And
wow.
That's the guy we're paying who's killing the Postal Service.
Well, is he appointed or is he, he's appointed?
He's
right?
Appointed, he's hired by what's called the Board of Governors of the Postal Service. And there's a whole other story behind that, because your president and mine has had 5+ years to fill empty seats on the Board of Governors, and he hasn't done it. He's left the old original Republican conservatives in place without taking action to bring new life to the Board of Governors so they can get control of the situation.
Has he nominated some that have not been appointed, or has he just not taken any action?
Before all this came to light and blew up, he nominated some people, but let's just say that we don't think that they're going to be helpful. Bank Act is an organization. We would like Obama to withdraw some of those nominations and nominate people who will take control of the situation, fire the Postmaster General, and work to revive and restore the U.S. Postal Service. It can be done, especially with postal banking, to help stabilize the finances.
So is Bank Act now focused on getting more mayors involved in this? What is your strategy at this point relative to growing the political footprint?
Yeah, the mayor's resolution has been so successful that we are going to have a vehicle through Bank Act that will carry on these resolutions and open it to all local elected officials, mayors, whether or not they're members of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, city council members, elected county officials, the dog catcher, if the dog catcher is elected, any local elected school board members, if it's a local elected official to support this resolution.
This is something then that you could use public grassroots active support. What can people do to make this a reality in their town or get their local support?
Right now we are gearing up for a grassroots campaign later this year in association with other local grassroots organizations to help make this happen. In the meantime, people can learn about the issue by going to postalbankingaction.org.
That's postalbankingaction.org.
Or, if that's too long to remember, just go to bankact.org. bankact.org, and you can
Bank
go
Act.
Through to it.
Okay.
B-A-N-K-A-C-T. Also, if people are interested in seeing the resolutions that were passed, that were adopted by the U.S. Conference of Mayors, they can go to a page within our website that we made it easy to find by giving it its own URL, postalpower.org. And there you can find the two resolutions, and you can find a slideshow that's talking to mayors, showing them why it was why it's so important to support these resolutions.
Well, this is a really exciting frontier. You know, things are the grassroots are starting to make a whole new level of noise in the political frontiers of public policy, and this is a very exciting and powerful one. Congratulate you on getting the postal unions, all four postal unions, and the Office of Inspector General to participate in this, and maybe we can light some candles for the Postmaster General and try to get him on board as well. It certainly is a worthwhile proposal, Ira.
That was Ira Denver, co-founder of BankAct at bankact.org. And that will do it for this week's It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, Nancy Becker, the Recorder of Deeds of Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, Kurt Helwig and Joseph Cohn from the law firm of Cohn, Swift & Graff of Philadelphia, the law firm that won the significant case. And also to Ira Denver of BankAct.org. For more information about BankAct, once again, go to BankAct.org. That's BankAct.org. For more information about public banking, go to thepublicbankinginstitute.org. And, of course, subscribe to Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com for her latest commentary and writings on the world of monetary control and what you need to know about it. Thanks once again for joining us on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown on the PRN Network at prn.fm, where podcasts of these shows are available to you at any time. I'm Walt McCree. Thanks for joining us.